Hello. In this audio snippet, we will continue talking about some of the things that we have been discussing in recent audio clips, and we'll be revisiting some concepts before moving on. So recently we've been talking about the economic principles that need to be embedded in the new American Constitution. And these are principles that the members of the House of Commons under the new Constitution, who we are calling the MCs, members of Commons, these are principles that the MCs need to understand, and be constitutionally limited by them. Because the problem we've had is that government has felt more and more in need of controlling the economy to make it work, supposedly. And this notion has come about as a result of the Great Depression. And the Great Depression was the result of the stock market and its inherently anti-capitalist nature and destructive nature that drains resources and drains investment from the economy and society. So this this horrible monster that we still have around today was what led to the Great Depression. The Great Depression became the excuse or the justification to begin developing a system of government where the legislators and the president feel that they need to pull strings like a puppet master with a puppet. Controlling the economy, tinkering things here and there, injecting money here, doing this, doing that, doing the other, to make sure that the economy succeeds. But the more this mentality, this philosophy has been allowed to creep in, the more intrusive government has become, and it has, in the long term, created much more harm than good. So that's why it's important that the new American Constitution be very clear that these are the economic principles the nation will live under, and create certain parameters that will be relatively stable and like pillars. And then legislators will not feel that they have some sort of power or responsibility to tinker with the economy, to inject money here, to raise taxes or increase spending or do all these things, or produce tax incentives to do this or that or the other. Because the more they do that, the more they distort the economic process and make society poorer and everyone poorer. So the Constitution will have these principles. They'll be very clear, clearly established. And then the MCs will not, and because they'll be bound by these principles, then there won't be much legislation that the MCs and or the president will need to produce and sign regarding the economy. And as long as they are guardians of these principles, then the economy should work on its own, by itself. And just as I'm saying that, we need to clarify that this is not going back to the laissez-faire mentality of Calvin Coolidge. Calvin Coolidge was the president, I think, between 1923 and 1928. If I'm not mistaken, he was the vice president to Warren G. Harding, one of the worst presidents in American history. When Warren G. Harding died, if I'm not mistaken, he took over as president, and then he won the election in 1924 and served out the rest of that term until 1928. And during his time, government had very little influence on the economy. So he let the economy run itself under a very strict laissez-faire mentality, let the economy do its thing. And we had, as a result, the roaring, what are called the Roaring Twenties, a period of great economic boom. And you would say, okay, that justifies a laissez-faire system. And yes and no. In part, his lack of intervention in the economy allowed the economy to prosper in certain ways. But the problem was that he was so laissez-faire that when people began to speculate in the stock market and taking out loans and putting themselves and their families in debt to invest in this charade that we call the stock market, this gambling casino, because he remained silent and allowed the whole system to just do it naturally, then we ended up with the crash, which happened 1 year after, more or less 1 year after he left. In other words, I believe he must have left the White House officially in early 1929, and the stock market crash happened in October of that year. But regardless, he was president up until 1928, and the little time between that and his actual departure was just a lame duck period. So basically, the crash happened 1 year after him, after his effective run as president. So he was not there to see the disaster that he allowed to happen. And also, at the same time, he was very silent on so many issues. Society, as this apparent prosperity was kicking in, American society became much more degenerate. There was a lot more prostitution and gambling. That's when the crime families, the mafia, started picking up considerably as well. And he remained silent on the whole matter. So there was a moral decay going on in American society, along with an apparent boom that was really just an illusion. And he remained aloof, you could say, throughout all of that. And that's why the economy collapsed. And it's his responsibility. Even though Calvin Coolidge is upheld like almost as a superhero in many conservative circles, because he supposedly represents what's so wonderful about laissez-faire economics. But in reality, he was also a big disaster, almost as bad as the person that he succeeded, Warren G. Harding. But he was he was bad because of what he did not do, and not necessarily what he did. We're not talking about having a system like that where the government just lets the economy do its crazy thing. We need certain parameters that limit certain types of activity, like the speculation in the commodities market, as we have more or less discussed before, and the elimination of stock trading, where you can profit from trading stocks, where you if you're buying a share, you're investing in a company and you're putting your money into the productive engine of the economy. And if you're going to profit from it, you will do so from the dividends that share will produce for you, because that company you're investing in is producing something. So certain parameters will prevent. It is not so much that the Constitution will restrict the economy or the freedom, economic freedom of people. It will actually, make illegal activities that do not foster the production or the increase in investment, the increase in production, the increase in capital. Anything that hurts the capitalist system, the system of raising capital to invest and produce, anything that does that will be illegal under the Constitution. And also at the same time, the MCs will be like watchdogs in society, looking out for things and trends that they will see as being harmful in the long term to the economy. And they will be sounding out the word a spokespeople, you could say, but they will not be legislating, doing things to direct the economy in a certain way. In other words, if they see some bad trend happening in the economy, because people are engaging in certain types of activities that are destructive in the long term, they will speak out against it, but they will not be empowered to pass legislation to produce tax incentives or things like that that will be unconstitutional, because we don't want to go back to these days of puppet masters in Washington, D.C., trying to control the economy, or people in the Federal Reserve thinking that they have the ability to control labor, unemployment rate, rates or inflation rates, and doing all this tinkering that is really not necessary. So we're not referring to a laissez-faire situation where we act like Calvin Coolidge. It is a situation where the Constitution lays out these principles, and the economy is supposed to follow these healthy principles, and the MCs will be there just to watch society and say things. And if they spot certain things that are contrary to the principles, then they can legislate against those things. But they will not be allowed to use the tax system as a weapon or spending in a specific way to direct the economy in any way. So I hope that makes sense. It is laissez-faire, but not Calvin Coolidge style. It is a system where we lay out clear parameters and point out in a very clear way, this is harmful to capitalism, this is not, and where we have a very simple tax system that will not be tinkered with except for minor percentages. And also where the money supply is, as we shared in the previous audio clip, the money supply will be controlled in a very mechanical way through a formula where if the GDP rose, let's say, by X percent in a certain year, then we know that the money supply needs to be increased by that X percent as well. And we described that the increase in money supply is not going to be through the means that are used now, which are very artificial. They will be through the injection of new money, physical money, into lending institutions, and it will be given to them not as money that they will own, but money that they are allowed to lend to their customers. So it really is nobody's money, and it becomes somebody's money when they take it out on a loan and invest it. So all new money that goes into the economy will be directed at investment and will not be owned by anyone. If you look, for example, online and ask, do a search online asking how does money get injected into the economy, you will find, at least that was my experience, that the answers are very iffy. Yes, they are accurate, but they don't seem to answer the question exactly. Some people say, well, the money supply increases through manipulation of the Federal Reserve rate. And but all of that has to do more or less with increasing the money, the M2 money supply, not the physical currency, but the money supply that is virtually available through loans. So it's really not related to how money, physical money, is injected into the economy. So, and some websites will tell you, well, what happens is that the government sometimes buys bonds. So they buy back bonds, you know, from bonds that have been issued to people who lend the government money, you could say. So they buy back the bonds and put money back into the economy. Because the moment that they receive the bond, then they pay out a certain amount of money, and the person who receives that money then goes out and spends, and that's how the money starts trickling into the economy. But then that doesn't answer the question. Well, that person received that person that the bond was bought from had that bond by giving that amount of money to the government. So if the bond cost $100, let's say, then the government received $100, and when they buy it back, they're giving back $100. So that really is not very clear. Okay, but what about the new money? How did the new money get into the economy? If I buy back the bond at the same price as I sold it, then there's no opportunity to inject new money into it. So the answers you find online are very iffy. It's like very confusing because the question boils down to, if the government prints out a new dollar, how does that new dollar bill get into the economy? And then other people say, well, what happens is the government does spending, and the moment they spend money, they take that dollar bill they printed and they spend it on something. And that would be a very direct way and very clear way where that new money goes into the economy. So the problem with that is that it relies on the government getting into debt, first of all. And second, it implies the government deciding who that new dollar bill goes to. So if they just say, okay, let's build a bridge to nowhere. We want to stimulate the economy. Let's build this bridge that no one needs, connecting two islands where no one lives, and we're going to spend $200 million doing it. Then, yes, they are giving out that, let's say that all those $200 million are new currencies that they, you know, print out. They crank up the dollar machine and they print out $200 million bills. And they go out and pay a whole bunch of contractors to build this useless bridge. And yes, that money is going into the economy through these contractors. These people are getting rich, and then they are buying Jaguars and Ferraris or whatever. And that's how money starts going into the economy. The problem with that is, first of all, it implies the government making decisions. And we all know government is not very good at making decisions on how to spend money efficiently. So the money will start going into useless projects. And second, the problem is the government decides who the money goes to. So the people who get the most benefit are the people who get that new dollar bill first, because that new dollar bill has the same value as it had before the transaction. But as the dollar bill goes into the economy, the dollar bill gets devalued because there's more money supply. So slowly that dollar bill loses its currency value. So by the time it gets to the 10th or 11th person that touches that dollar bill will be worth less by that time. So the people who benefited are all the people who touched the money first. And that means that the government is artificially enriching some people more than others. So it's very random. And the best way to deal with that is to have it be very, very neutral. All lending institutions, and that doesn't just mean banks, and I did not clear that up last time, that there are lending institutions that are not necessarily banks. But even though most of them are, even if they look on the surface to be a separate company that lends money, usually there's a bank behind them, but sometimes there isn't. But the thing is that any lending institution, whether it be a bank or not, can register with this national bank, and the national bank will be aware of these lending institutions and rank them based on their success in lending success. In other words, how much success is each institution having with the money they lend out? Are they giving out bad loans that people, you know, default on? Or are they giving loans to good investors or good entrepreneurs who are producing great companies and producing great dividends and who are able to pay the loan back? So these lending institutions will be rated by their loan quality, and then that number will be multiplied by their assets. How many assets does that company does that lending institution have? Because the company that has the more assets deserves the more money. because that, for example, that would mean like a bank that has more branches. That means that they have more access to more customers that can take out loans from them. So they deserve more money by that. But if they are giving out a lot of bad loans, then the money that is allotted to them should be diminished. So those two factors get combined in a multiplication. And so each at the end of the day, each lending institution will get a number, which will be the product of these two values. Their loan success index, you could say, times their assets. And each lending institution will have a number. Then you add up the numbers that you get. Then you get a total, and then each institution gets a percentage based on their number relative to the total. And that's how the money will get into the system. It belongs to no one, so it's not we are enriching anyone in particular. And then each lending institution now has more money to lend. And then we'll start giving out more loans, and then some investor will take that money as a loan. And because it's a loan, he does not feel like he can just spend it willy-nilly. He will try to invest it and generate more goods and services, and the economy will become richer and richer. So that's how the money supply should be increased. And that would be in the Constitution. It would be very mechanical. And the MCs will have nothing to do with it. The National Bank, right now called the Federal Reserve, and its chairman will have no say. And we won't need to be listening to Alan Greenspan figures telling us, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that to make the interest rates go this way and that way to reach a target inflation rate. The National Bank shouldn't be targeting inflation rates, shouldn't be targeting unemployment rates. That's not their job. Their job is to make sure that the money supply that's in the economy is consistent with the goods and services that economy is producing. And that's all they should be doing. And then everything else should take care of itself. So that's what we've been talking about. And just as a side note before continuing, a clarification on the commodities market that we have briefly discussed. It is worth saying that much of commodities trading is legitimate because it involves actual consumers of the commodities purchasing those commodities in order to consume them. Like, for example, in the commodities market, you hear a lot about futures contracts. And if I'm not mistaken, basically what that is that two parties agree that party A will provide party B with X amount of a certain commodity at a certain price by a certain date. So for example, an airline company can go to a fuel provider and sign a contract that says, by the end of September, I will receive from you, I don't know how many, X thousand gallons of airplane fuel at a certain price. And that's a contract. So when the contract is due, and I think the term is closed or something like that, when the contract expires, then the fuel provider will provide those X million dollars worth of fuel to that airline at a certain price. And if I'm not mistaken, the contract also includes details about how the distribution will be done. In other words, how the physical fuel will be delivered to the airline. So that's how the future contracts work. And they are all legitimate because we're dealing with actual goods and we're dealing with the actual consumer. And that's the problem with the stock market currently, that there really is no final consumer of the stock. Who is really the final consumer of a share? It's just this hot potato that gets passed around because no one can eat a share and it's not like a television set. There's the final consumer is the one person who buys it, goes to, and sets it up in his house and watches it. So in the commodities market, there is a final consumer, and there is an actual product, and there's a distribution. So it promotes the growth of the economy. It promotes production. There's a distribution process and all of that. So it's all legitimate. The problem is with speculators who come into the market, and they have no interest in buying fuel or corn or metals or whatever. They might be trading out of their basement in their underwear. They have no interest in, no place in their garage to store 100,000 gallons of airplane fuel. They couldn't care less, but they go out and buy these establish these contracts, and the contract says, I'll, by the end of September, I will receive X thousand gallons of airplane fuel. But they have no intention of receiving that money. So what they're doing is they're speculating, hoping that the fuel price will go up. And just before their contract closes out, then they go and sell the contract to someone who really wants the fuel. And hopefully for them, the fuel price will be higher at that time, so they will make some money on that. And that's all they're doing. So they're injecting themselves into the trading process just to... like vultures, just eat out some of the profit. And so instead of that money going into the producer's hands, that extra money, it's going into their hands. They're just getting in the way of the process. So they are like leeches, leeching off of the actual production process. And that should be unconstitutional. That should be illegal. And the same principle would apply with stocks as with these contracts, that if you want to sell it off to someone, you have to sell it off at the same price. You cannot profit from the trading of shares or the trading of futures contracts or commodities unless you are actually, so the only way to in the case of the commodities market, there is no profit, quote unquote. There's just buying and selling. So an airline buys the fuel, they'll shell out money. There's no profit there. The profit is when they use that fuel to fuel up their airplanes and then transport people, and the people are paying them for that travel, their air travel. So that's where they make their money, not from the commodity, but from the use of the commodity. We just wanted to clarify that it's not that commodities trading is evil per se. It's when the speculator leaders come in, and the Constitution needs to ensure that is illegal. So So having said that, we do need to also point out something very important about the money supply and inflation. So we've been talking about how to increase the money supply and to make sure that it's done in such a way that it doesn't promote inflation or deflation. But then the question becomes, what is the connection between money supply and inflation? The answer is, well, yes, there is a strong connection between the two. and the increase the amount of money, the money supply amount, is a very crucial factor in whether or not there's going to be inflation and by how much. But it's actually, I would dare say, very naive to think that the money supply is the only reason or the only factor for inflation. And I've gone online and I've read some people who say that very strongly, and I've heard it myself also over the years. This idea, and I believed it myself for a while, that inflation only happens if there's more, if the money supply is artificially increased. You know, when people, when governments start cranking out money, and yes, obviously, when they do that, that will cause inflation, because as they always say, there's more money around chasing the same amount of goods and services, so naturally the prices have to increase. Yes, that is true, But let's consider one scenario, and this will help to, I hope, clear up some of the things that are going on at the time of this recording with supposed shortages and energy crises that are going on, some of them a little bit exaggerated, but there's some reality to it. So to put everything in context, let's do a thought experiment. And let's consider a situation where the economies of the world are running as usual, doing their thing, and then suddenly, for some reason, the oil runs out. In other words, the planet Earth just has no more oil to give to us, and it's all over. So one morning, we all wake up, and suddenly the news around the world is, we have run out of oil. So what would happen in that situation? Let's say we take the one country, let's say America, and let's say that we have a good government under the new American Constitution where the money supply is not being tampered with in an artificial way, where we're doing what we've been describing. Everything had been running normally and fine. Everything was prosperous. But now there is no oil. Or, you know, so, and that means that there, the little oil that had been pumped out of the earth is what is left. So, the oil reserves that we have right now is all we have from now until the end of time. That's it. So, the morning that happens, the morning that America, for example, would wake up to that, we would enter into chaos because, you know, everybody needs petrol, needs gasoline to run their cars. And now we know that there's no more oil. So the little oil that was that we have in our reserves, that's all we have. So naturally, there is a very low supply and the demand is the same as before. So now, obviously, prices will have to go up, and that's natural because there's no more oil to give around as before. So the higher price is the only way to be able to control that no one gets too much of it. So it, just by the laws of supply and demand, oil prices will rise, and that means the gas prices will rise. And any industry that relies on energy to produce its goods and services will have to pay more because now oil is more expensive. And as a result, then their products are more expensive. So you will see a generalized just explosion of inflation throughout the economy. And did the money supply increase? No, the money supply didn't increase. And what some people say, the people who believe in this notion that the money supply is the only factor behind inflation, they say, well, now that if a certain good becomes scarce, then the price of it will increase. And that means that, let's say, and supposing that it's a very important good that people need to buy, then they will still continue to buy it at a higher price, but because the price is higher, then they have less money available to buy other goods. So the demand of other goods goes down, and because of that, their prices will go down. So on average, the average price for the entire economy will stay the same. But the problem with that thinking is that in this scenario that we just pictured where the world runs out of oil, is that yes, we won't be buying other stuff, but what will happen is because we won't be buying other that other stuff, well, the price will not necessarily go down because the production of that, all that other stuff we're not buying anymore, also dependent on oil. So the prices of that will also increase, even the demand will not be increasing. So, so there is, in reality, no way of saying that inflation will be zero if we leave the money supply the same if oil runs out. So from that thought experiment, then we can say that Inflation is really a combination of two things. The money supply increasing too much, and another factor is the misallocation of resources, whether intentional or whether out of negligence or due to uncontrollable circumstances. When resources are misallocated, then inflation will ensue in one way or another. In this case, for example, with the oil, because we were running economies that were so dependent on oil, and we didn't foresee that oil was going to run out the next day, then we were investing in our economies were applying all their resources into things that depended on oil. And the moment oil ran out, then all those processes that depended on oil became inefficient. And that means that all the resources applied into those oil-dependent factors were misallocated, because we should have been spending on other forms of energy so that we would be ready for the day when oil ran out. So, and that's where MCs would come in and say, hey, society, I know you're all depending on oil, you're oil happy, but we foresee that oil will run out in, you know, 5 years or so. And we recommend that you start investing in other forms like nuclear power, or, you know, combination with tree hugging technologies, you know, with wind power and hydroelectric power and all other things. We need to invest in those things, but without the MCs really doing any legislation to promote that. It's just them speaking out. And that then we will begin to allocate resources towards other forms of energy, so that when oil runs out, we will continue to be fine. So inflation can be triggered by resources being misallocated. Like, for example, when if we take a whole bunch of money and build a lot of useless things, then we will destroy the economy, because we're draining resources towards things that have no utility. And that's what happened a lot with communist countries, and it's happening right now in China. As you may know, there's a company called Evergrande at the time of this recording that is on the verge, if it hasn't already, on the verge of going bankrupt. It has these excess, incredibly large amounts of debt, and it's about to go belly up, and it's much, much bigger than the biggest companies here in the U.S. And invested a lot of money in real estate and building buildings and condos and things like that. And there are cities in China that are, in communist China, that are full of these high-rise buildings that are empty, built by Evergrande and others, because they were investing in all these condos thinking that they would be full of people and no one is living there. And the Russians, the Soviet Union had the same problem. They were very good at producing large amounts of steel and iron and all this, but no one was using it because everything was so controlled, so planned, and bureaucrats were very bad at planning things. So they would plan on producing all this, all these goods and services, but because they were, it was all artificially being controlled, then they would produce too much of it, so they would just rust away somewhere and not be used. And that just drains resources, creates scarcity, and then the things that needed to be produced are not produced, that creates short supply, and then that triggers inflation. So that is what I would believe is the more important element of inflation that most people overlook. That if you misallocate resources, either, you know, through just outright negligence or because you didn't foresee something like the case, that thought experiment of oil running out, when that happens, then resources go into one thing, then the supply of things that we really need gets reduced, and therefore inflation arises. And that's what we have to watch out for. That's what legislators should be looking out for and speaking out about. But with very little power to legislate over certain things, we cannot have the House of Commons in the future American Constitution legislating tax incentives or some sort of government subsidies for green energy, like the nonsense we've had for so many years with Tesla and other companies that are losing money, and we keep subsidizing them. That's another source of misallocation of resources that makes life more expensive for the rest of us. If electricity works as a source of power for cars on its own, let the economy prove it. Let it be successful on its own. If it can, if Tesla can succeed on its own, then so be it. Good for them. But if they need subsidies, then we're artificially propping up a company that's actually losing money and taking more resources from society than what it's giving back, and we all become poorer, and the prices of other things becomes higher by consequence. So it's very important to mention that. And now, just before closing, it's worth speaking a little bit about what's going on at the time of this recording, because there are rumors going around of shortages in food and other things. In the UK, people are queuing up to buy petrol because it's scarce, and it's being said that it's because there's a lack of drivers transporting the petrol, the gasoline around, and that's why there are shortages. In India and in other places or throughout the world, gasoline or petrol prices are going up and up, and no one seems to be clear on what's going on. And part of what's happening is that I would dare say the first factor that is triggering all of this, and it's said when you go online and do a search, no one is saying this. And it's shocking to me that no one is looking at this as a factor that's affecting everything, because everyone, especially economists, tend to see things through political eyes. Nowadays everything is political, even medicine has been politicized, so it's not objective as it used to be. But the fact is that one of the driving factors is that everybody knows that the senile bastard who's shuffling his feet in the White House at the time of this recording has done everything to undermine the production of energy by the United States. We all know what he did. Well, that son of a bitch, who will burn in hell very soon, did to the Keystone pipeline here in the U.S., and we know how he is doing a lot of things to promote oil production in other countries, and doing everything in his power to prevent the U.S. producing. And just so you know, for example, if you go online, you'll find that in August of 2018, the U.S. Became the world's largest oil producer. And that is a shocking thing. I remember many years ago as a kid when I would hear about OPEC here, OPEC there, and we all believed, okay, the oil is somewhere in the Arab world under Arabs' feet, and we are totally dependent on them for oil. So it's shocking when you think about it that by 2018, the U.S. had finally been able to become the world's largest oil producer. And we had, maybe we were the largest oil producer way in the past, but we had lost that as OPEC, the Arab countries began to rise. But we gained it back in August of 2018 when Trump was in the White House. And in September of 2019, the oil, crude oil production in the U.S. Increased to a record of 12.1 million barrels per day. And that was a record at that time. And it was the first time since 1973 that America was exporting more oil than it was importing, which is shocking. So finally, the U.S. was becoming energy independent. And not only were we becoming energy independent, we were helping provide others with oil. And by doing that, we lowered the power even more of OPEC, OPEC Plus, I think they're called now, OPEC and its allies, like OPEC and friends. So they're called OPEC Plus. So we decreased their power even more, and we made oil cheaper for everyone. And I would dare say that was the fuel, literally, behind the economic explosion that we had during the Trump years before the pandemic hit. But the thing is that now, oil production in 2021 at the time of this recording is around 11.3 million barrels per day. In other words, you know, 0.8 million barrels down. And it's anticipated that it's going to stay kind of at that level through the end of the year and into the future. So we can see right there that the senile bastard who stole the election and is shuffling his feet in the White House at the time of this recording has been a big factor in reducing American oil production. And we're saying that it's decreasing even though we are supposedly returning to economic activity after the pandemic. And because of the rhetoric, the very strong anti-oil, anti-energy rhetoric from the senile one, then that has emboldened other people on the outside to say, okay, we're going to put the pressure now and start shortening oil supplies, because that's what OPEC Plus is doing right now. They are reducing the oil supply. They lost a lot of money when the pandemic hit and the economies were not producing and needing oil. Oil prices dropped dramatically, and these people lost a lot of money. So they're trying to make it back, and also knowing that the bastard is the senile son of a bitch is not going to do anything about it, then they are artificially controlling their supply in order to keep prices up to kind of make up for what they lost in this artificial pandemic, which should have never happened. They should have never had a vendetta against us if we had been doing things right, but because we weren't, they lost a lot of money, and then they're trying to get it back now, and they know that the U.S. has no plans of restarting its energy growth. So now they say, okay, now the U.S. and the world depends on us more again, and so they're holding back on their supply of oil. And the same thing is happening with Russia. Russia is at this time kind of being very controlling of its supply, especially because it wants to enter into some. There's a Nord tunnel thing that they, or whatever, I don't remember the name, I apologize for that, but there's about to enter into some sort of project in Europe, and in the meantime they are controlling their oil supply, and that is also contributing to the oil prices increasing, and then that starts leading to inflation, because right now we have two things that are that have led to a great misallocation of resources. We're spending money on people not working. We've been subsidizing unemployment with the excuse of the pandemic. So a lot of resources have been going into people who are not producing anymore, and that's why people are not going back to work as they should, because they're depending on government help, and all because of the pandemic. And the other thing is we are not investing in energy production, which was happening under the Trump reign. But now we have gone away from that. And those two misallocation factors are contributing to inflation. And on top of that, the third factor is the son of a bitch and his demon rats in the Congress are spending like drunken sailors and injecting more money, and they are printing out more money. And all of those three factors are contributing to inflation as it is. But none of this would be happening under the new American Constitution that we are talking about. We would have never entered into a plandemic. And there will be other things that we'll be talking about in future snippets to make sure that we'll need to be added to the new Constitution to ensure that this plandemic type situation never ever happens again. There has to be a clause in the Constitution clearly stating that any legislation has to be that claims to that impose attempts to impose restrictions on individuals needs to have a clear backing based on science and other factors. So they can't just say, "Oh, you have to wear a diaper on your face," and just because we say so. No, there has to be scientific evidence supporting that legislation. There has to be clear statistical data, and if someone can produce statistical data that disproves the scientific validity of a certain mandate, then it should be revoked automatically. No questions asked, because it has to be based on science, not on what Tony Fauci or some other bastard who will burn in hell very soon has to say or thinks. Who the hell cares? Pardon my French. Who in Sheol cares what these people think? It is the truth that matters, and the Constitution should make that very, very clear. We've been kind of like rehashing many things mentioned in previous audio clips. But I hope that we've added a little more meat to these concepts. And I know that when these things get plastered in that new American Constitution, we'll be on our way to a truly free society with a free economy where people will be able to produce and where government will not be interfering in any negative way other than to maintain the principles that keep us free and prosperous. So we'll be continuing to talk a little bit about taxes, and then we'll be moving on in future audio snippets, and we'll retake some concepts about the legislative process per se as well. Thank you very much.